listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. How Trump Fades Away. Media domination doesn't last forever. Just ask Sarah Palin, by Peter Hamby. Opening photograph by Penelope Umbrico, and it shows a stylized photograph with Trump and Sarah Palin on TV. Back in January 2015, when I was a reporter for CNN, I did a weekend live shot from the Iowa Freedom Summit in Des Moines, one of those political cattle calls where Republican presidential hopefuls take turns on stage professing their Christian faith before a crowd of people harvested from a Grant Wood painting. Most of the supposedly serious 2016 contenders had flown to Iowa: Scott Walker, Ted Cruz, Chris Christie, Mike Huckabee. Like most very savvy political journalists at the time, I laughed off Donald Trump's appearance as just another thirsty White House tease. And having covered Sarah Palin up close since she was chosen as John McCain's running mate, I knew her best shot at the Republican nomination was back in 2012. Soon after the segment aired, CNN President Jeff Zucker, who is always watching, emailed me and a few producers demanding that we not cover Trump or Palin, explaining that both Republicans were carnival acts, attention seekers, two unserious distractions from the real presidential race to come. I think about that moment from time to time, and not just because CNN's position on covering Trump so famously changed once he actually became a candidate, delivering ratings galore. It's also a reminder of how Trump and Palin were lumped together by the smart set as little more than a sad and desperate right-wing sideshow, when in truth they were two of the most consequential political figures in American history. These days, Palin has receded to an historical footnote and a punchline for a news media that's become even more cocooned in its urban bubble since 2008, with Trump now receiving most of the credit for upending the presumed order of national politics. But it was Palin who opened the door for Trump, the first politician to fuse backlash politics and anti-elitism with the mighty American power of celebrity. The impact that she has had on rejuvenating almost the Republican Party, it's been unbelievable, Trump said of Palin in 2008. After McCain lost, Palin resigned as governor of Alaska, but continued to gather strength as a fixture on the conservative political circuit, publishing a best-selling memoir, headlining Tea Party rallies, joining Fox News, and coming close to running for president in 2012. And she did most of it while bypassing the lamestream media by posting her musings and rants on Facebook for an enormous community of diehard fans. Like Trump, Palin had powers beyond the campaign trail. She wore a celebrity halo rarely seen on a politician. Her traveling circus in the fall of 2008 proudly embraced redneck America, Hank Williams Jr. and Gretchen Wilson, hunting and fishing, Carhartts and Walmart. Her crowds were rapturous. Rural Americans and working people who didn't go to college saw her as one of their own, while liberals and journalists loved to mock her lack of sophistication and manner of speaking. Tina Fey's scornful impression of Palin on Saturday Night Live was only the beginning. After Palin came on the scene, as Nancy Eisenberg recounted in her book White Trash, A History of Class in America, Hollywood unleashed a crop of new shows: Swamp People, Here Comes Honey Boo Boo, Redneck Island, Duck Dynasty. And Palin would go on, fittingly, to star in her own reality show, Sarah Palin's Alaska, produced by Mark Burnett, Trump's beloved producer. Barack Obama later wrote in his 2020 memoir, A Promised Land, that Palin's explosive rise was a sign of things to come, a larger, darker reality in which partisan affiliation and political expedience would threaten to blot out everything, your previous positions, your stated principles, even what your own senses, your eyes and ears told you to be true. More than any politician before her, Palin made politics purely about cultural identity, and there would be no turning back. Obama left readers to draw the obvious comparison to Trump. Whether Trump was watching closely or not, Palin carved out a new path to power. And now, in his post-presidency, Trump's future might also look a lot like Palin's. Out of the White House, and essentially deplatformed from Twitter and Facebook, Trump is inhabiting something of a media time warp, now much more dependent on traditional media for attention. Palin's moment in the sun, which began more than a decade ago, offers a possible glimpse into how the next few years will unfold for the former president. And how his hold on Republican politics and the media will fade. Between 2009 and 2011, Mitch McConnell might have controlled the official levers of GOP politics in Washington, but no Republican occupied the public consciousness more than Sarah Palin. The country might have had its first black president in office, grappling with seismic economic distress, but Palin was the entertainer-in-chief. Her face was splattered on magazines, on cable and broadcast news, on Entertainment Tonight and Access Hollywood, on Oprah and CBN, on Facebook and Twitter, on weirdo fan blogs and international news sites alike. And with a $100,000 a pop speaking fee, TV contracts, and her memoir, Palin was monetizing the whole time, making upwards of $12 million in the year after leaving the Alaska governor's mansion, out of power, but more powerful than ever. Palin leaned into the media chaos with a smile and not an ounce of restraint, giving her limitless political abilities. When Palin coined the phrase death panels during the fight to pass Obamacare, it became the Tea Party's signature rallying cry, repeated endlessly, despite being a falsehood. Her appearances at conservative conventions and Tea Party rallies, often while wearing jewelry festooned with American flags, were aired in full on cable news, with reporters assigned to follow her every move. Palin's ability to raise small-dollar donations from grassroots conservatives was unparalleled, and she became the most coveted endorsement of the 2010 election cycle. Its memory holds now, but Palin's stardom continued unabated all the way through late 2011. Her flirtation with running for the 2012 Republican nomination, never ruling out a bid and allowing supporters to build an operation for her in Iowa, kept her in the headlines. Her newest advisor, a filmmaker named Steve Bannon, helped position Palin as a populist alternative to the crony capitalism that had infected Republican politics. In the summer of 2011, she announced a One Nation bus tour of historical sites up the East Coast, making stops at Fort McHenry, Gettysburg, and Bunker Hill, teasing a presidential run with her telegenic family in tow. Local TV news choppers chased the bus driving up Interstate 76 to air live coverage. ABC News added an interactive map of the tour to its website. Only that October, when Palin declared that she wouldn't run, did her influence begin to wane. Media attention drifted from Palin to the presidential race and to wackier Tea Party characters like Michelle Bachmann, Herman Cain, and the birther kingpin himself, Donald Trump. Mitt Romney wrestled the nomination away from his conservative rivals, temporarily snuffing out the restive grassroots wing of the GOP. Palin lingered on the scene, still showing up at conservative events, posting on Facebook, and handing out endorsements. But her shtick just got old, fading with time. Fox News dropped Palin in 2015. Her husband, Todd, later divorced her, a story that made barely a ripple. When she appeared in Georgia late last year to campaign for Republicans, journalists shrugged. Right now, for Trump, that kind of political trajectory from the center of the known universe to a lesser moon orbiting Pluto feels like an impossibility. Unlike Palin, Trump was an actual president who changed the course of history, with a vice grip on the Republican Party and most of its voters. But the center of gravity in politics always changes, and with his social media megaphone gone, Trump is operating in a media environment that looks a little more like 2011, when the establishment media had a bit more power, and a little less like 2021. Yes, there are more conservative outlets today, and more discreet communities where the cult of Trump can flourish. But going back to his real estate days, Trump's power has always depended on the mainstream media's attention to his antics. Shortly after Trump decamped to Mar-a-Lago and White House outrage subsided, Marjorie Taylor Greene, the QAnon Karen, became the new media obsession. Palin is the perfect analogy here, said Adam Kinzinger, one of the few never-Trump Republicans in Congress, who also happened to be blessed with a Palin endorsement back in 2010. She was this fierce populist figure, and people couldn't get enough of her. And then it stopped. Trump will certainly be relevant and a player in the next cycle, but that will decrease over time. And without Twitter and the trappings of power, I think people will get tired of him. People will finally start to see he's not as powerful as he claims to be. As a hockey mom from Wasilla once said, you betcha. Thank you. Now for this month's cover story, Continental Rift. Two brothers, alike in dignity, among the British monarchy, where we lay our scene, are grappling with ancient grudges. Will it, should it, be mended? By Michelle Ruiz. Opening photo shows the brothers dressed in suits and looking in opposite directions. Before she was Her Royal Highness, the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle referred to herself as Rango's mermaid. The phrase comes from French-Cuban writer Anaïs Nin's autobiographical novel, The Four-Chambered Heart, which Meghan quoted often in her suits era. "I must be a mermaid, Rango. I have no fear of depths and a great fear of shallow living." Meghan wanted more than the middling cable TV success. Elizabeth Tuke, her publicist from 2014 to 2016, encouraged her to go out for blockbusters. "You could be the next Megan Fox," Tuke told her. Instead, she embarked on a USO tour to Afghanistan, Spain, Italy, Turkey, and England, traveled to Rwanda to build wells for clean water, and campaigned against menstrual poverty among schoolgirls in India. "She is this super ambitious woman," Tuke added, which shouldn't be a dirty word. Meghan did press Q&As in her car on the way to set at 4 in the morning and affirmed her respect for Tuke's role in their written agreement, with language that declared Meghan would never minimize me as a person or my prowess in the field. Her advocacy peaked in what was, at least by March 2015, one of the biggest nights of her life, a speech at the UN Women Conference. Meghan flew herself to New York and stayed with her mom, Doria Ragland, at the Peninsula Hotel. Tuke lent Meghan her own dress, a black design by Preen with a deep V-neck, and they shed happy tears in the hotel room. "We clinked champagne glasses. We hugged. We bounced up and down," said Tuke, who runs her own boutique public relations agency. It was like she was going off to get married. Next photos. Prince Harry and Meghan's Oprah sit-down drew 21.3 million viewers on CBS. Princess Diana gave a similarly sensational interview in 1995. Meghan and Harry have kept up a united front. The same qualities that made Meghan a superstar, that she's outspoken and passionate about women's rights, and as a biracial woman, has a unique ability to connect with people who feel voiceless, made her uniquely qualified for modern duchesshood. They also rendered her a threat. As Prince Harry divulged to Oprah, his family welcomed Meghan until they got to see how incredible she is at the job during the couple's 2019 South Pacific tour. That brought back memories. "Not happy ones," was his implication. Princess Diana, dazzled with her youth, beauty, and former nursery teacher's touch, crouching to hug small children, in stark contrast with royal women who extended their gloved hands in greeting. During a 1981 visit to Wales, in which frothing crowds lined the streets, subjects cried for Diana and all but groaned at Prince Charles. The princess had everything going for her, except the ability to not upstage the prince, Prince Charles's valet, Stephen Barry, once said. Soon after, she outshone Queen Elizabeth at the opening of Parliament. Rather than the literal throne, all anyone really cared about was the fresh-faced Diana in white satin David Sassoon and the lover's knot tiara. After Wales, Diana had expected to be lavished with praise by the palace for her heroic efforts, but no response was forthcoming, Tina Brown wrote in the Diana Chronicles. "Diana couldn't understand why nobody said well done," recalled a former palace aide. "Perhaps because, like Meghan, she exposed the monarchy's wooden ways." Like Diana in her diary, Harry and Meghan were suddenly too electric, said Anna Pasternak, author of The Real Wallace Simpson, a new history of the American divorcee who became the Duchess of Windsor. They made the Cambridges, Bill and Kathy, goes the joke, seem dowdy, suburban, and rather dull. That does not go down well in the palace. For continuity's sake, the House of Windsor prefers to train the spotlight on the monarch and her direct heirs. Hence the 2019 Christmas portrait, in which only the Queen, Prince Charles, Prince William, and Prince George made a performative pudding. 3 decades later, Meghan was staring down the paradox that had plagued her mother-in-law. The royal family demands duty from the women who marry in, to relinquish normal life, and their passports, according to Meghan, in service of the crown. But if they're too sparkly, the palace, like a sullen teen, gets jealous and resentful. It's a no-win predicament, familiar to women, and women of color in particular. You're either too much or never enough. When Meghan and Harry announced their decision to step back as senior royals last year, the fusty palace establishment started to push Meghan and Harry away completely. Diane Abbott, the first black female member of parliament and former shadow home secretary, told Vanity Fair. Instead of protecting the monarchy, the firm's alleged unsupportive treatment of the Sussexes has only lurched the institution into existential crisis, fueling questions about its colonial roots and Britain's systemically racist present. The Queen is a figurehead for an empire that refuses to understand that its days are gone, said Keleki Okafor, London-based host of the Say Your Mind pop culture podcast. Diana came along, and then Meghan Markle came along, and everything started to fall to pieces. Next photos, a young Harry perches atop his mother's shoulders. Diana captures Australia's heart during a 1983 royal tour. Prince William and Harry bow their heads at Diana's funeral. At the heart of the most explosive royal scandal since Diana and Charles divorced are their sons, brothers William and Harry. Now 38 and 36, respectively, they're seared into the collective memory as solemn adolescents who shuffled behind their mother's coffin, remaining collected while strangers across the world wailed. As Harry told Oprah, "We've been through hell together." For 2 decades after their mother's death, William and Harry ran in the same posh, polo-playing Eton social circle, partied at Mahiki with mutual friend Guy Pelly, and later stood at each other's side at the altars of Westminster Abbey and St. George's Chapel as best man on each other's royal wedding days. For a long time, Harry was a merry third wheel and fun uncle to the Cambridge kids, but Kate and William getting married and having children really exposed to Harry that he, too, wanted to have a family, said Harry's friend and former British Army training partner Dean Stott. Never mind that each of William and Kate's children bumped Harry further down the line of succession, making the constraints of royal life seem increasingly redundant. With their marriages, their personalities seemed to diverge, and so did their roles within the family business. William, the stoic elder brother and heir to Kate Middleton, his English rose from St. Andrews, on and off for the better part of a decade before their 2011 nuptials. They seldom so much as hold hands in public. The rakish, emotional Harry took longer to settle down. See also Strip Billiards in Las Vegas, but fell hard for Meghan, the first biracial divorced American royal bride ever, in a whirlwind 18 months. William reportedly expressed concern about Harry and Meghan's romance, telling his brother, according to royal correspondents Omid Scobie and Carolyn Durand's Finding Freedom, to take as much time as you need to get to know this girl. The brotherly bond further frayed as their wives navigated their own relationship, including the now infamous clash over bridesmaids' dresses. While friends of Meghan, including Jessica Mulroney and Lindsay Roth, have spoken out in her defense, many in Harry's circle have remained quiet because they're friends with both princes. As Stott said, you can't go against one or the other. Together, the brothers' wails might have represented a new generation of royal. Instead, William and Harry are playing out the dynamic of their parents, Pasternak says. Harry tracks with Diana, a rebel spirit, fueled by fury at the tabloid press, blowing up the family's cone of silence in a blockbuster interview. Meanwhile, she says, William is very aligned with his father in his sense of duty above emotion. The direct heirs remain apolitical, almost to the point of ridiculousness, sidestepping the issue of racism in the process. For all their philanthropic efforts, the royals were notably silent during the Black Lives Matter movement last spring. "We're talking about bloodline," said Kenya Hunt, author of Girl, 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 on womanhood and belonging in the age of black girl magic, and deputy editor at Grazia UK. "How does a conversation about racial equality and diversity jive with this institution that boils down to a single white Protestant family?" As president of the Football Association, William has spoken out against racism in the sport before, including in January when he condemned despicable abuse against Manchester United player Marcus Rashford. In the fallout of the Oprah interview, the Duke of Cambridge found himself making a rare public statement to declare, "We're very much not a racist family." It begs the question, why didn't you speak up against racism put out against your own sister-in-law, says Shola Moshungbamu, PhD, the British intersectional feminist activist and author of This Is Why I Resist, Don't Define My Black Identity. Prince Harry has repeatedly described himself and Prince William as on different paths. While the elder brother inches closer to the throne, Harry and Meghan are unmuzzled in Montecito, California, on the brink of becoming philanthropic media moguls a la the Obamas, between their Archwell organization and plum deals with Spotify and Netflix. Harry has gone from working royal to working as chief impact officer at mental health startup BetterUp. Forced to formally relinquish their royal patronages, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex have pledged to continue a life of service. The partners listed under Archwell's nonprofit arm seem hatched from their own lived experiences, including activist Rachel Cargill's Loveland Foundation, which focuses on providing affordable mental health resources to black women and girls, and the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education at Stanford Medicine. Going through their own struggles has given them an acute awareness of suffering, says James R. Doty, M.D., C-Care's director. The Dalai Lama is founding benefactor. When Doty met with Meghan and Harry at Stanford last year, they were very down to earth. They were thoughtful, they were inquisitive, and they seem intelligent and self-aware, he said. I've been in situations where people ask to get involved, and it's for their own self-interest, he added. My sense is that they are extraordinarily engaged, and this concept of compassion deeply resonates with them. During her Makers conversation with Gloria Steinem last August, Meghan mentioned Algorithms of Oppression, a book by Sophia Umoja Noble, Ph.D., co-founder and co-director of the UCLA Center for Critical Internet Inquiry and a leading scholar on the harms of the Internet to black women and girls. Around the same time, Noble received an email from the Duke and Duchess's chief of staff requesting a meeting. I was like, is this a scam? She laughed. After meeting with Meghan and Harry, both avid readers, according to Noble, she and the center became one of the Archwell Foundation's five named partners. The way that I understand it from Meghan, Noble says of her book, is that it helped her make sense of her own experience of being trolled in these racist and sexist ways. Clickbait targeting women of color and vulnerable communities is lucrative, Noble explained, and Meghan was being treated like a commodity. That wasn't just specific to her, although it was, Noble adds. She was caught in a system, too. Harry recently joined Katie Couric and Catherine Murdoch, among others, as a commissioner on the Aspen Institute's Commission on Information Disorder. Meghan is poised to reimagine her past lifestyle influencing, according to Tuke. Netflix and Spotify are essentially the Instagram to her TIG. Expectations are high for Team Sussex's next move, with political rumors swirling around Meghan, due to give birth to a daughter this summer. But supporters say the Duchess should also be afforded space to heal after sharing a traumatic experience in high public fashion. Nalini Stamp, National Organizing Director at the Working Families Party, says if a black woman goes through harm, she doesn't have to solve it for other people right away. Doty, who said he Zoomed with the couple the day before our interview, pointed to the vitriol that's been directed at them even after airing their mental health struggles. Some people go, well, you signed up for it. You should have been prepared for this. I'm not sure anyone can prepare for this. The British monarchy is built on mystique and magic, the wonder of real-life princes and princesses, and a life altogether unlike our own. But their latest family feud chips away at the idea of royal exceptionalism. To hear Meghan and Harry tell it, the Windsors are just another dysfunctional family. The firm, one more toxic workplace, where HR is not your friend, and there's a total lack of diversity in upper management. When you're talking about Buckingham Palace, it's tempting to think you're just talking about individual members of the royal family, Abbott says. Actually, there are so many courtiers and advisors and staff. They are the people that actually run the royal household and advise the Queen and Prince Charles. Princess Diana lamented the presence of shadowy men in gray. Long before her, Wallace Simpson told Prince Edward, "It is the job of the courtiers to turn everyone against me." As a member of Parliament since 1987, and one of many women in it who signed a public letter condemning the colonial undertones and tabloid narratives about Meghan, Abbott says this coterie strikes a monolithically white, male, and upper-class profile. What Bonnie Greer, the American-British playwright and former deputy chair of the British Museum, calls bloke culture. According to Stott, who has raised money for the Royal Foundation, formerly shared by the Cambridges and Harry, stiff palace staffers feel like they're protecting them, but actually they're doing a disservice to the royal family. The labor movement had a moment when Meghan alleged that human resources denied her request for mental health resources, even as she had suicidal thoughts while pregnant, because she wasn't a paid employee. "In my old job, there was a union," she said of the Screen Actors Guild, "and they would protect me. The firm is like a classic corporate boss," Stamp said, comparing the Sussexes' exit to Britney Spears' ceasing work under her father's conservatorship. "Meghan and Harry actually went bye-bye. We're withdrawing our labor." The entrenched male establishment at the palace seems unlikely to engage with the racial firestorm now burning outside. Meghan and Harry's allegations of racism within the royal ranks is fueling a deeper reckoning on race in Britain. "If you can treat a princess that way," said Parliament member Dawn Butler, "just imagine what ordinary black women go through every single day." Just as the 1619 Project sparked a re-examination of the Founding Fathers as enslavers in the U.S., an interrogation of the monarchy's colonial roots is underway, including its integral role in the British slave trade. Prince Charles called it an atrocity in 2018. The Queen has never commented. The crown that would sit atop Kate Middleton's head as Queen Consort is forged with the estimated $300 million Koh-i-Noor diamond, which has a bloody history, writes Smithsonian Magazine. Britain has maintained the gem as a gift, while India's Ministry of Culture has called for its return, saying it was seized during colonial conquest. Traditionalists point to the Queen's affection for the Commonwealth, a union of 54 nations, including Australia, Canada, and many majority black and brown member states like India, Jamaica, Barbados, and the Bahamas, almost all of which were once British colonies. Meghan had the signature flowers of 53 embroidered into her wedding veil, a gesture of her commitment. But the pretense is getting harder to sell to colonial subjects of color, particularly black people who are descended from slaves, Jamaican writer Kitanya Harrison said. The British are very good at subjugating people and making it seem civilized. The whiff of colonialism lingers. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has referred to citizens of the Commonwealth as flag-waving pickaninnies. In 2018, immigrants who had come to the UK from several Caribbean Commonwealth countries during the Windrush era of 1948 to 1971 were wrongfully detained and deported. In Jamaica, the Queen's English remains deeply ingrained as a superior language to the native patois. When recently given the opportunity to waive a patent key to the development of COVID-19 vaccines, the UK was among the wealthy nations who declined to share it with developing Commonwealth countries like India and South Africa. Colonialism never really ended, Harrison wrote in an essay for Medium after the Oprah interview. It changed clothes and lowered its voice a bit. Harrison didn't watch the royal wedding or celebrate the representation of a biracial woman in the monarchy, calling it an assimilationist fantasy. Why do so many people seem to covet a seat at a table they should want to flip and set ablaze? The monarchy has weathered many storms. 1992's Annus Horribilis, when three of the Queen's four children split from their spouses and her beloved Windsor Castle caught fire, comes to mind. So does the present hypocrisy of launching a formal investigation into vague reports, alleging that Meghan bullied staffers, while Prince Andrew, a one-time acquaintance of Jeffrey Epstein and an accused pedophile, lies in wait, safely ensconced at Grace and Favor Property Royal Lodge. Andrew has denied the allegations that he forced Virginia Giuffre to have sex when she was 17. But Harry and Meghan's potent public allegations of racism and negligence pose a specific threat to Prince Charles's long-awaited, by him, ascension. I think the monarchy as we know it will last as long as the Queen is alive, Abbott said. After her death, I think there will be a big public debate. And I think what the royal family and their advisers did with Meghan will be part of the argument for change. Abbott anticipates the debate to reach the floor of Parliament, with a clamor to look at the current arrangement and maybe move to a more Scandinavian monarchy, where you don't have all the pomp and ceremony. Next photos, Harry hams it up for the crowd. Harry and Meghan at Archie's christening. Diana and Prince Charles pose for their 1981 wedding photo. Meghan shares a laugh with Queen Elizabeth II in 2018. Charles, Duchess of Cornwall, and Meghan attend the Prince of Wales's 70th birthday garden party. The Fab Four make their way to Christmas Day church services in 2018. William and Harry enjoy the 2017 European premiere of Star Wars, The Last Jedi. Meghan and her mother, Doria Ragland, wave to wedding well-wishers. Harry and Meghan at their Windsor Castle ceremony. Reigning 69 years and counting, Queen Elizabeth commands a level of broad popularity and respect, even among non-royalists, that Charles simply does not. Harry's revelation that he feels really let down by his father and the crown's recent excavation of Charles's affair with Camilla Parker Bowles while married to Diana did the heirs no favors. "I'm not 100% sure that we will see Charles ascend to the throne," Pasternak said. "The Sussexes have sparked something so fundamentally incendiary in this country that it is changing the face of Britain, and I think the monarchy as an archaic institution may well topple." Busting the palace's meticulous Operation London Bridge succession plan for the Queen's death would seem unlikely, but it may be that there is such a groundswell of public opinion against Charles that it's deemed by the firm preferable for William to ascend then because he's younger, more relatable. Without Queen Elizabeth holding the Commonwealth together, member states are likely to drop out, predicts Martin Weiner, Ph.D., a research professor at Rice University, specializing in British history. It'd be like, who wants Charles to be our head? We're stuck with Charles. The monarchy's saving grace may rely on a reunion. The opportunity will present itself in July at the unveiling of a statue of Princess Diana on what would have been her 60th birthday at Kensington Palace's sunken garden. The royal media is spiraling, with some reports assuring that William and Harry, along with Kate and Meghan, the short-lived Fab Four, are still committed to appear together. Others deem it unthinkable. Both sides are like wounded animals, Pasternak said. Harry said there's been an awful lot of hurt. Well, there's been an awful lot of hurt now on the side of the Windsors from this interview. Harry has yet to finalize travel plans for the summer, according to a source, but he had been planning to attend prior to the Oprah interview. Public opinion is divided along generational lines. According to post-Oprah interview polling, 36% of Britons still support the Queen and the monarchy, while 22% sympathize with the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. 28% are indifferent. But only 16% of 18 to 24-year-olds back the crown, compared to 60% of the 65-plus set, who believe Harry and Meghan were treated fairly. For Harry, returning home could amount to walking back into the viper pit. There would be front-page headlines saying, "After all the damage you've done, you should keep away from here forever," said Peter York, co-author of the official Sloane Ranger Handbook. After the abuse lobbed at her by the tabloid press, "I truly wonder if Meghan will ever set foot on British soil again," Pasternak speculated. But the optics of a broader reunion are certainly desirable for a crown in crisis. The ideal reconciliation will be if, in some way, the Queen can engineer it while she's still around, York said. It would serve the monarchy to show that, as it were, brotherly love, grandmotherly love, had triumphed. As Harry told Oprah, "Time heals all things, hopefully." Before long, William will have arguably one of the most important jobs in the world, and he's going to need the support of the person who has been his right-hand man since he was a child, said Micah Meyer, founder of Beaumont Etiquette. There's nobody that knows him quite like Harry. The Fall of the House of Hammer. Armie Hammer's life seemed beautiful from the outside, perfect wife and kids, sparkling Hollywood career, but a glimpse into his family's dark past reveals how the shocking allegations of rape and abuse may be the latest chapter in a fraught legacy, by Julie Miller. Armie Hammer already needed crisis therapy. The world was under lockdown last summer, and Hammer had been quarantining at a luxury villa in the Cayman Islands with his father, Michael, his stepmother, Misty, his two young children, and his wife of a decade, Elizabeth. It was a very complicated, intense situation with big personalities all locked into a little tiny place, Hammer told British GQ. I think, to be quite frank, I came very close to completely losing my mind. He compared himself to a trapped wolf who wants to chew his own foot off. Hammer had been so desperate to escape the Caymans that he booked a flight back to the U.S. A source close to Elizabeth claims that his decision to flee his family during a pandemic was the ultimate affront in a marriage that had already been tested by infidelity. She filed for divorce in July. By January 1st, Hammer seemed to have rebounded romantically with a series of short-term girlfriends and was ready to face the world anew. 2021 is going to kneel down before me and kiss my feet, because this year I'm the boss, Hammer tweeted. Now I know what we are up against, and it's time to go to war. Several weeks later, however, Hammer found himself in a darker crisis. Amid the turmoil of divorce proceedings, several women took to social media to accuse the actor of emotional abuse, manipulation, and violence. The scandal ballooned as screen grabs circulated that seemed to show the actor describing sexual fantasies involving rape and cannibalism. Hammer stepped away from two high-profile projects, a rom-com with Jennifer Lopez and a Paramount series about the making of The Godfather. Shortly after, his agency, WME, dropped him. Then, in mid-March, a woman came forward with detailed allegations of rape and an attack so violent that she thought he was going to kill me. In a press conference with her lawyer, Gloria Allred, Effie, who declined to give her full name, recounted a 2017 assault that lasted for several hours, in which Hammer slammed her head against a wall, bruised her face, and whipped her feet with a crop. Hammer's lawyer, Andrew Brettler, has maintained that all interactions between Mr. Hammer and his former partners were consensual, releasing correspondence between Effie and Hammer over the course of a 4-year relationship. But as Allred emphasized to Vanity Fair in an earlier interview for this story, while adults may consent to some BDSM practices, they still have a right to withhold consent to other practices. For the people who know Hammer's family, peppered with Russian communists and American oil tycoons, the allegations are an unsurprising development in a long and sordid history with drugs, sex, dysfunction, and betrayal. Many men in the Hammer family have a dark side, sources close to the family say, one that looms across 5 consecutive generations. Sins of the Fathers. The family's first brush with scandal was in 1919, when Armie's great-great-grandfather, Dr. Julius Hammer, gave the wife of a Russian diplomat an abortion. Julius was a Russian immigrant living in the Bronx and a central member of the Communist Party of the United States, according to biographer Edward J. Epstein, who published Dossier, The Secret History of Armand Hammer, in 1996. The woman, Marie Organasoff, died days later. Julius was convicted of first-degree manslaughter and sentenced to 3.5 to 12 years in Sing Sing. With Julius in prison, his 22-year-old son, Armand Hammer, Armie's namesake, abandoned a medical career to take over his father's other business, Allied Drug. According to Epstein, Vladimir Lenin sent a message to Joseph Stalin encouraging particular support for Armand, telling him this is a small path to the American business world, and this path should be made use of in every way. Armand moved to the Soviet Union in 1921 for about a decade to fortify family connections. While there, he married a Russian singer named Olga, and together they had a son named Julian, Armie's grandfather. By the 1950s, Armand had divorced Olga, as well as a second wife, Angela, who had told the court that due to his time in Russia and his medical training, it causes him no pain to see the sufferings of others. He moved to Los Angeles, married a wealthy woman named Frances Barrett Tolman in 1956, invested her money in the then-failing Occidental Petroleum, and drove the company to incredible success. Armand tried to distance himself from his Soviet connections, reimagining himself as a self-made industrialist. He even hired a journalist to ghostwrite a memoir, The Remarkable Life of Dr. Armand Hammer. He had a private Boeing 727, palled around with Prince Charles and high-powered politicians. He was a close friend of Senator Al Gore Sr. and attended the inaugurations of Franklin D. Roosevelt, Ronald Reagan, and George H.W. Bush, among other presidents, collected expensive artwork, and convinced Chinese leaders to lend two pandas to Los Angeles for the city's 1984 Olympics. He died in 1990. But in 1996, Epstein's bombshell biography exposed the late Occidental Petroleum chairman for wide-ranging grifts, including laundering money, using artwork to fund Soviet espionage, bribing his way into the oil business, and knocking off Fabergé eggs. According to Epstein, Armand bugged his office and home, plus his cufflinks, to record decades worth of conversations. He had a fixer and was known to do business with a briefcase full of cash. He also made an illegal contribution to the Nixon re-election campaign, which, in all likelihood, according to the New York Times, went to help pay for the Watergate cover-up. Though he faced a felony charge for obstructing justice, a Washington lawyer helped him plead guilty to misdemeanor charges, and Bush later pardoned him. Armand had multiple mistresses, including Martha Kaufman. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.